And thank you for coming to the program tonight on physician-assisted death, physician-assisted suicide. I'm grateful to Shai Shamayim for hosting tonight, and to Jeff Lipsitz, as always, for his energetic help in setting up and promoting the program. If you haven't received an email from Jeff Lipsitz, I question whether your email address is working. We have sign-in sheets over with the source sheets on the table, although I'm not sure the source sheets are there anymore. We might have finished the stack. But there are sign-ins over there. And please do sign in. If you haven't yet, please make sure to do so at some point, because, number one, I always like to be able to follow up on the discussion with additional thoughts, but especially on a topic like this, where really what I'm going to present tonight, I feel are first thoughts rather than conclusions, and I'd like the opportunity to be able to follow up afterwards as my own thinking develops on the topic. Assisted suicide or assisted death. Suicide has been legal in Canada since the 1970s. 1972 was the year when it was removed from the criminal code. So ever since then, in Canada, a person would have the right to take their own life. What happened in the Supreme Court's decision of a couple of weeks ago is that the court also decided that the criminal code's ban on advising somebody on suicide, helping somebody to commit suicide, or even allowing somebody to commit suicide, that all of these prohibitions are inconsistent with Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms, because there is a line within the Charter which says everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of the person, and the right not to be deprived thereof except in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice. So their argument is that preventing people from helping somebody to end their own life violates the right to life, liberty, and security. If you take a look at the first source on your sheets, and not everybody has, please do share, you find an excerpt from the Supreme Court's reasoning. Section 241B of the Criminal Code says that everyone who aids or abets a person in committing suicide commits an indictable offense. And S14 says that no person may consent to death being inflicted on them. Together, these provisions prohibit the provision of assistance in dying in Canada. Insofar as they prohibit physician-assisted dying for competent adults who seek such assistance as a result of a grievous and irremediable medical condition that causes enduring and intolerable suffering, these lines 241B and 14 of the Criminal Code deprive these adults of their right to life, liberty, and security of the person under S7 of the Charter. All that they've said so far, just to penetrate the legalese, is what we said in the beginning, that by prohibiting a person from helping somebody to end their life, or from prohibiting somebody from permitting somebody else to help them end their life, we are depriving people of their right to life, liberty, and security. And now they explain their reasoning. The right to life is engaged where the law or state action imposes death or an increased risk of death on a person, either directly or indirectly. Here, the prohibition deprives some individuals of life, as it has the effect of forcing some individuals to take their own lives prematurely, for fear that they will be incapable of doing so when they reach the point where suffering was intolerable. You follow the logic? Right? The logic is that if people know that should the time come when they wanted to end their life, they wouldn't be able to do so, that could cause them to end their own life earlier. So therefore, we will assure people that when the time comes, they will be able to get assistance from somebody else. You follow? Now, the truth of the matter is, the nature of that assistance is subject to some debate. This has been written up in the papers over the last few days. I think I saw an article that Jeff sent out about it. In truth, this is subject to debate because there's a difference between two kinds of physician-assisted suicide. There is physician-assisted suicide, meaning that the physician provides the means, but the patient is the one who does whatever it is. So, for example, the physician prescribes some pills that the patient can then choose to take. That's one. And the other is euthanasia, in which the physician is actively involved in administering whatever it is that's going to cause the patient to die. From my perspective, if your argument is that the right to life is being infringed upon because the patient feels like maybe the time will come when I can't do this and I need help, then you really ought to be permitting not only physician assistance in terms of writing a prescription, but you ought to be permitting euthanasia as well. Right? The logic is, you hear the logic? Right? If you're going to tell me that the concern is people end their lives for fear that they won't be able to end their lives later, then maximize what you're providing for them and say, so then euthanasia also should be allowed in order to be consistent. But that's point number one. The second point they make, the rights to liberty and security of the person which deal with concerns about autonomy and quality of life are also engaged. An individual's response to a grievous and irremediable medical condition is a matter critical to their dignity and autonomy. The prohibition denies people in this situation the right to make decisions concerning their bodily integrity and medical care, and thus trenches on their liberty. And by leaving them to endure intolerable suffering, it impinges on their security of the person. They no longer have the liberty to make their own decisions about how they will be taken care of, because if they want, in fact, to end their lives, we're not permitting them to do so. And they don't have security in the sense that they can be forced to endure intolerable suffering, or not forced to endure it, but prevented from avoiding it. That's the argument that the Supreme Court accepted in this ruling. The court recognizes that there are many people who should be protected by such legislation that says you're not allowed to help somebody commit suicide, but they're concerned that the legislation is catching people who are outside of that group, outside of those who should be protected. That by applying a law which says you're never allowed to help someone take their life, your law is too broad and applies to situations where it ought not to apply. So they've given the legislature 12 months to rewrite the law. It's anyone's guess what's actually going to happen. You can read the editorials and people are speculating, will they bother to write a new law? Will they just leave it out there? How will they write a new law? How is this going to affect the elections, and so on and so forth? What I'd like to do tonight is to deal with three questions. Number one, what would Jewish law say about ending a patient's life actively or assisting a patient in ending their life? Number two, what would be a response of Jewish tradition to these concerns about life, liberty, security? And number three, if Jewish law is not going to accept assisted suicide, and again, we're going to go through that, but if the answer really is no, then what alternatives does Jewish law offer for a person who is in this irremediable pain? Or is the answer then just to say, sorry, that's not an option, or is there something that can be done? So we begin with our first question. What would Jewish law say about ending a patient's life? So it is certainly true that actively ending a patient's life, or actively ending anyone's life, frankly, is not allowed in Jewish law. If you take a look at source number two, you find a verse from Bereshit, the book of Genesis, in which God declares, "Umiyad ha'adam miyad ish achiv ed rosh as nefesh ha'adam." From the hand of the man, from the hand of a man for his brother, I will seek the life of the man. Meaning that if somebody strikes somebody else, God is going to punish them. Rabbi Jacob Tzvi Mecklenburg was a rabbi in the 19th century. He wrote a commentary to the biblical text called Haktava VeHaKabbalah. And he commented that the murder here is characterized in two different ways. From the hand of the man, as in one man who hit another, and the hand of a man for his brother, somebody who strikes his brother. And what he suggested in his commentary is, this is describing two different types of murder. He's writing this in the middle of the 19th century. He says, one would be where somebody attacks somebody else to harm him, and the other would be where someone does it as a brother, out of love, feeling that this person is in pain, and I can end their life, and that would actually be a brotherly act. In other words, this is not new. The discussion about ending somebody's life to avoid pain is far from new. Nonetheless, the trend within a Jewish law is indeed to prohibit it. And I brought you source number 3, Rabbi Chiel Michel Epstein, writing in the very end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, in the city of Novardok, in which he codified in his code of law that even if somebody is in great pain, and it will be better for him to die, we are still prohibited from doing anything, he says, to hasten the person's death. And indeed, like the Canadian Criminal Code said until a couple of weeks ago, the Jewish law had a prohibition as well against permitting somebody else to inflict harm on one's person. Yes?
Back one step, the Jewish law prohibits suicide.
Yes, but the last source that I referenced, that I just mentioned, it's not written on the sheets. It's the Talmud in Bava Kamma, says that one is not allowed to be chovel be'atzmo, one is not allowed to wound himself, and he's not allowed to license somebody else to wound him either. Just as, until 2 weeks ago, Canada's criminal code said, I'm not allowed to license somebody else to harm me. So that is all within the existing prohibitions of Judaism. However, because there's always a however, take a look at the story in source number 4, because that one requires some real thought. A passage out of the Talmud. It's the story of Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion. Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion is a rabbi living in Israel in the first century Common Era under the Romans. The Romans at the time have decided that these pesky Jews who are rebelling against them and rejecting their authority could be crushed if only this Torah of theirs, this tradition that they keep teaching to their descendants, if only that could be cut off. If we could get the Jews to stop teaching their children, then we would be able to break their identity and they would be assimilated into the Roman Empire. And they come up with several tactics toward this end. The one that's directly relevant is they decree that if anybody teaches Torah in public, they will kill the teacher as well as the student. Keeping in mind that this is long before printing press, and it is at a time when Jewish law is communicated verbally and not in writing, that's an exceptionally effective way to cut off the chain of Jewish tradition, because you can't teach it. Well, Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion defies them. He goes out in public with a Torah scroll, and he assembles students, and he teaches. And he is caught. And then you see what happens in source number 4. Heviuhu v'karchuhu b'sefer Torah. They, the Romans, brought him, Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion, they wrapped him up in his Torah scroll. V'kifuhu b'chavilei zemoros, they bound him up with vines, v'itzisu b'hen asa'ur, and they kindled them, they lit them on fire. Heviu sfogin shel tzemer, they brought sponges of wool, ushra'um b'mayim, they soaked them in water, v'inichum al libo, and they put them on his heart, k'dei shelo teitze nishmaso meheras, that he should not die quickly. They didn't want only to execute him, they wanted to torture him. They wanted to make such a display that nobody would dare defy them in the future. Amr lo talmidav, so students address him, and one of the things they say is, Psach picha betikanes picha ha'esh, open up your mouth, let the fire enter, die quickly. To which he replied, Mutav shi yitzlena misha nesana va'al yachavel hu, or al yachbol hu be'atzmo. He says, better that the one who gave me life should be the one who takes it back. I will not do anything to harm myself. If you stop the story here, It sounds like a statement against any form of suicide or having somebody else assist in suicide, right? That's what it sounds like until here. But then you watch what happens next. Omar lo klatzdoniri. The executioner says to him, Rebbe, my master, imani marbe bishalheves, if I were to increase the flame, v'notel sfogin shal tsemer me'al libcha, and if I were to remove the sponges from on your heart, would you bring me into the next world? The Roman executioner has a change of heart and says, I'm willing to mitigate your suffering. I'm not going to save your life, but I'll make you die faster and with less pain. Would you bring me into the next world? Amar lo hein, he says yes. Hishavali, swear to me, the executioner demands, and Nishbalo, and he swears, and that's indeed the way the story plays out, is that he does this. So here's the problem. We have a biblical verse, V'lifnei iver lo titein michshol, do not put a stumbling block in front of the blind. That verse is not only taken literally, it is also taken figuratively. To say that, you're not allowed to do anything which will mislead somebody, Jewish or non-Jewish is irrelevant, into wrongdoing. You can't cause somebody else to stumble. You can't cause somebody else to sin. Well, if that's true, how does he license the executioner, and not only license, but encourage the executioner to hasten his death? If you're not allowed to speed up someone's death, and there's no doubt that he is in what the Supreme Court would have called a what was the term that they used? I'm missing the term right now. Grievous. Yeah, I mean, it's grievous. It's irremediable suffering. He is going to die, and he's going to die with great pain. So the Supreme Court would have said, well, this is clearly a case in which he needs help to die. And he, in fact, is inviting somebody else to help him in it dying. Granted, he didn't initiate it. The executioner was the one who initiated it. But he responded positively. So how could he do that if you're not allowed to assist somebody in dying? What would you say? Sorry? Was incompetent. What do you think? Could be. I want to come back to that. Yes, Rita. Excellent. That's a very important point, is that withdrawing the sponges is not directly administering something which will kill. I'm going to come back to that also. Yes? Okay. Yes. So it is certainly true that there's an element of double effect in the sense that the goal is to remove pain and the goal is not to administer death. And yes, you are correct that we're going to have to come to that one. Yes. Good. He increases the flame, killing him faster, but that's certainly an action which will hasten death, different from removing the sponges. So some of the commentators, when they look at this case, and it is dealt with by various authorities, some commentators suggest that the prohibition of lifnei iver, not to cause someone to stumble, doesn't necessarily apply to his case. And I gave you in source number 5, I was not going to bring every text on this, but I gave you references for those who do wish to look it up. But the one argument is that the prohibition against causing somebody to stumble is a basic prohibition in the Torah, but it's overridden in a case in which someone is suffering so terribly. It's a basic low-level prohibition, and that it could be overridden. That's one argument. Another argument that's brought, well, basically the two arguments, I suppose, go hand in hand. But the other argument is that here he's allowed to because, well, this requires a little bit of explanation. Normally we say that when it comes to a prohibition in the Torah, a person is allowed to violate the prohibition in order to avoid losing all of his wealth. If a person would lose all of his money if he wouldn't violate the prohibition, he's allowed to violate the prohibition, because otherwise he'd become indigent. And the argument goes that in the event that a person is suffering like this, he would gladly give up all of his wealth to avoid this kind of suffering. If so, then suffering like this is worse than losing all of one's wealth, and therefore, just like losing all of one's wealth would override the prohibition of causing somebody to stumble, so too, going through this pain overrides the prohibition against causing somebody to stumble. If you didn't catch that, it's okay. There is a recording later, but also there are other ideas that we need to get to that are more directly relevant. Some answer this by saying, by offering factors that are unique to this case, to this particular issue at hand. You can see I listed them in source number 6, but I'm not going to go into them other than to note that Rabbi Lau, in the second of those bullet points in number 6, does suggest the withdrawal of treatment approach that was mentioned before, saying that, well, this was a withdrawal of treatment rather than an act of killing. I don't know how he would deal with the fact that you're also raising the flames. I'm not sure about that. But you see there a range of answers that are offered. And then I wanted to show you one answer in particular, which I thought was really interesting. I will not recommend it. I'm simply mentioning it. The laws that govern Jews under the Torah, meaning the 613 mitzvot that Jews are given as part of the Torah, are for Jews specifically. Non-Jews have their own code of law within the Torah, that is 7 Noahide laws. One of those Noahide laws is indeed not to kill, but it doesn't necessarily have the same rules as the Torah's prohibition against killing, because it's in a separate context entirely. And on that basis, in source number 7, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein offers a remarkable idea. And again, I'm not suggesting it should be used. I'm just pointing it out because I think that it's a fascinating point. He suggests that it might not have been wrong for the executioner to do what he did because the executioner is not Jewish. And he argues, as you see there in number 7, that there is a qualitative difference between murder on the one hand and mercy killing on the other. And he argues that when it comes to the prohibitions God places on Jews, indeed, it could be that both of them are prohibited, but that the prohibition for non-Jews may not include the mercy killing. Effectively, if we were to carry this through, and even Rabbi Feinstein himself only suggests this as a hypothetical and not a practical, but what he actually seems to suggest is that a non-Jewish physician would be allowed to do this, would be allowed to engage in euthanasia, and to give the extreme case, or in assisting, where a Jew would not necessarily be allowed to. I thought that was a really interesting approach. But overall, what we're seeing is, and what we've said so far to sum up what we have, is, as a general rule, the tendency of authorities in Jewish law is to say that one would not be allowed to take his own life, and that one would not be allowed to end the life of a person who was in fact in pain, with the caveat that this story involving Rabbi Hanina ben Tradyon does make us ask, well then wait a minute, how did you bring in the executioner? We're not done with this case. We need to come back to this case, and to the point that Tammy made before regarding the question of whether he's really considered to be competent was the word you used, to make this decision at this stage. So I want to come back to that question, because it's going to matter a lot as we go forward. But that's point number one. Everyone understands where we are? Whether they accept or don't accept, agree or don't agree, but everyone understands what we've said. Okay. Second stage, within this first question still, even if you're going to tell me that Jewish law will not allow the active ending of a patient's life, what about enabling someone to take his own life? What about giving the pills? And the patient will take the pills when the patient chooses to. Really, the question is the patient allowed to take his own life? Or would I be in violation of lifnei iver? Would I be in violation of causing the patient to stumble by providing the pills? So, as I said before, there is indeed a prohibition against harming oneself. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 8, you see Maimonides codifying it. Asur la adam lachbol bein be'atzmo bein b'chaveiro. One is not allowed to wound himself. One is not allowed to wound any other person. And I brought you in the Hebrew. I actually brought you longer text, but the English conveys the idea. Why does Jewish tradition prohibit taking one's own life? Or harming oneself? What would be the rationale? Sorry?
Mm-hmm. You have to live this life.
Right. So one approach is, it's not yours. Life is God's property, not your property. If you take a look at source number 9, writing in the 15th century, Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra, in his commentary to Maimonides' work of law, says simply, "Shei nafsho shel adam kinyano." A person's life is not his property. Ela kinyan HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It is God's property. And therefore, you don't get to decide when it's going to be taken, how it's going to be taken. Going back to the wording of Rabbi Hanina ben Tragion, when he initially said, "I'm not doing anything to end my life, let the one who gave it to me be the one to take it away." And that's one approach. What else? Jerry?
Well, it's interesting that in the Ten Commandments, when it says you shouldn't commit murder, it doesn't say that the differentiate between yourself and others.
Right.
It talks about later on about wanting someone else's stuff, taking someone else's stuff. There's a distinction. It's murder simpliciter, whether it's you or anybody else.
Right. So a second approach is to simply say, and I'm not sure that this is exactly what you're saying, but it sounds to me like the implication of what you're saying, that all life is said to be of equal value, regardless of the nature of the particular situation, and therefore subject to the law of thou shalt not murder. Is that where you're...
Including yourself.
Right, including one's own. If you take a look at source number 10, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach says something like this. When he writes, "Ha'inyan shel chayim ein lanu shum knei midah kama limdod et yokram v'hashivusam." He says, we have no measuring stick to use for life, to gauge its value and its importance. Even if the person cannot fulfill Torah, the person cannot fulfill the commandments, nonetheless, he says, look, we would violate Shabbat to save the life of, as he puts it here, an elderly, ill, boils-ridden person who is deaf and mute and entirely insane and can perform no commandment. It doesn't make a difference. And he goes on through the passage. You can read it there. He continues to say, we wouldn't necessarily want you to perform any medical act to extend a person's life of pain, and that's its own topic. But he says, we view it as life, regardless of whatever is wrong with it, and you can't override the inherent value of the person's life. And that's a second approach. A third approach is that suicide is considered to be a rejection of faith in the next world. That's a third approach to it. Rita. Right. Now, there certainly are practical considerations in addition to what we're talking about, including the idea that research could develop new methods and so on. There's a deep philosophical issue involved from a Jewish perspective as well, and I credit Rabbi Baruch Weintraub for pointing this out to me. In general, when you look at Jewish tradition, we are against permanent actions. We view ourselves as changeable people. So that when you look at biblical law, you find that actions that are going to affect a person permanently tend to be prohibited. Examples of that: one cannot sell himself as a slave forever. One is not supposed to take vows. One is not allowed to get a permanent tattoo. All sorts of different ways in which the person is reminded, you're changeable, you are flexible. Don't do something that's going to be permanent and irreversible. So we have this trend against suicide. And yet, just like before when we saw the story of Rabbi Hanina ben Travion encouraging somebody to end his life, even though we said you're not supposed to end someone's life, now when we're saying you're not supposed to end your own life, we also have a source in which a great figure from Jewish history seems to end his own life. Take a look at source number 11. The passage involves, of course, Shaul HaMelech, King Saul. There is a war being waged against the Philistines. Vatichbad hamilchama el Shaul. The war turns heavily against Saul. Vayimtzeuhu hamorim anashim bakashet vayachel meod mehamorim. The archers find him. They shoot their arrows at him. He is suffering greatly. He's been pierced with arrows. Vayomer Shaul anosei kelav. And Shaul says to his armor bearer, Shlochar becha v'dokreni ba. He says, unsheath your sword and stab me. Because otherwise they're going to come to me and they're going to stab me and they're going to abuse me. But his armor bearer is afraid to do it. I'm going to kill the king? I can't do that. So what does Saul do? Saul takes the sword and he falls on the sword, ending his own life. And so, if we've just spent the last, I don't know, 5-7 minutes reading sources that say that Jews aren't supposed to kill themselves and presenting justifications for why it is that one is not supposed to end his own life regardless of circumstance, how can you explain what Shaul does? How can you explain what Saul does? And in fact, the sages commenting on this in the Talmud state that Saul was deserving of full eulogies and full honors, just like anybody else. There was no penalty appropriate for what he had done. He's from the Talmud's perspective, he's done nothing wrong. So now the question is, how do you deal with this? You just told me that a person is not supposed to end his life. What justification could you offer? Yes, Ellen. You're talking about illness in this particular situation, or are you talking about beyond this? Yes. Right. So Ellen points out that Shaul in general is very difficult to... you can't diagnose someone across thousands of years in a different continent without meeting them, not unless you're a pundit on the news. So in terms of figuring out what's going on, it's a good question, but the description of him in Tanakh uses terms that we associate with depression. That's the terminology that it uses and the description of what made him feel better and what made him feel worse and what he did when he was gripped by this state. So outside of his experience at the end of his life, something is going on with him in general. And certainly, here he is on the battlefield. He's been shot through with arrows. He knows he's not going to survive. And he knows what they're going to do when the Philistines capture the Jewish king. Okay. What other answers could be offered? Yes?
Seeking to prevent a worse outcome, like desecration of his body, the mocking of the Jewish king. So maybe in his mind, that was the lesser of those evils.
Right. One approach is to say that what he's trying to avoid is not his own suffering. What he's trying to avoid is the suffering of the nation. He's doing this on behalf of the nation itself. Could be. Other approaches? So take a look, please, at source number 12. Nachmanides, writing in the 13th century, says something a little bit cryptic. He writes, he says, if a person kills himself without intent, meaning that the person did not have sound mind at the time that they did it, he says, we don't withhold any honors from them. And he gives a story involving a child who actually did this. And he goes on to say, V'am Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Tarfon said, regarding the case of the child, Ein mon in mimenu kol davar b'pnei sheya tinok, ukshelo ledat bigadol dami. He says, that was a child. And that child is viewed as not being able to give proper consent to what he's doing. He doesn't know what he is doing. He's like an adult who isn't in his right mind. And then he continues to say, and this is the part that's directly relevant, he said, so we find regarding an adult who kills himself knowingly, but because of ones, because of a situation in which he is effectively coerced into doing it, we would eulogize him. In other words, we give him full honors. Nothing is lost. Kigon, and he gives you as an example, Shaul Melech Yisrael. Saul, king of Israel, she'ibed atzmo, he ended his own life, ela shehaya ibudo mutar lo, but it was permitted for him, and he quotes Midrash on it, lefichach lo haya bechlal me'abed atzmo ladat, he was not considered to be killing himself intentionally. The wording that he uses for this, regarding Shaul, regarding Saul, is that this was a case of ones. It was a case of something that was beyond his control. If you take a look at source number 13, Rabbeinu Asher, writing in the end of the 13th century, I'm not sure if he wrote this when he was in Germany, pre-1303, or post-1303 when he was in Spain, but he writes the following, Haya ibud mutarlo. He says, Saul was allowed to take his own life. Suicide was permitted for him. And he quotes the Midrash that Ramban, Nachmanides, referred to in source number 12, Kedeisa Vibracious Rabbah. The Torah says, V'achas dimchem l'nafsho sechem edrosh. I will demand your blood from your lives, the biblical text says. But as the Midrash explains, the text begins with the word but. Ach. But I will demand your blood for your lives. And the Midrash says, when you begin a verse with the word but, it means that you want to exclude something from the class of cases. And what this text is trying to tell me, as understood by the rabbis in the Midrash, is that it means to exclude the case of a person who is suffering. So what you see here is that both Ramban, Nachmanides, and Rabbeinu Asher, also known as the Rush, two principal authors of Jewish law, living in the 13th century, both of them believe that Shaul, Saul, is justified because of the pain that he is enduring. Flip the page. Actually, I'm sorry, I didn't bring this on the page. You flip the page anyway, because we're up to it. But the Code of Jewish Law codifies this. Shulchan Aruch Yeridaya Shin Mem He Gimel, for those who want to look it up later, 345.3 in the Code of Jewish Law, deals with suicide in the case of great pain. It does not approve it, but it says we certainly would not remove honors from a person who did this. Now, it's not entirely clear. What I brought you in source number 14, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, writing at the end of the 20th century, his argument is, and I won't read it out loud in the interest of time, but I wanted to spell out what he says. He says, it's still prohibited, but it's understandable. It's still a prohibited thing. If someone comes and asks, may I do this? The answer is still to say no. However, it's at least something that can be comprehended and understood, and that others do not have the right to criticize. That's the way that the Rabbi Waldenberg deals with it. There are others who provide other justifications and explanations for what Saul did. One argument is he wanted to prevent the Jews from trying a rescue mission. He felt that more would be killed trying to save him. There are other answers that are offered. But what we've seen in this is that when it comes to taking one's own life, it is true that it is presented as an across-the-board rule. However, there is an understanding of the person who says, I can't deal with this, what I'm facing is unbearable. And it is not viewed as being in the same category as other cases. So going back to the case of Rabbi Hanina ben Tragion, and the question with him, where he is, again, suffering in this same mode, and he knows he's going to die. It's only a question of how quickly it is going to happen. Potentially, the same justification may be offered. The answer may be that he is actually justified in what he is in would have been justified in ending his own, and therefore it's not wrong for the executioner to assist. Maybe, possibly. As I said in the outset, and not everybody was here in the beginning, so I want to make sure to repeat it. What I'm presenting here are our first thoughts on a subject, rather than definitive conclusions. But this is where my thinking on the topic is at the moment. I saw a couple of hands. Shira.
Can that be applied to terminal illness as well? This is too much for me. It'll be too torturous, so I'm going to end my life now.
I don't know. The question is, could this be applied to terminal illness in general? And a person saying, this is too much for me, I'd like to end it now, rather than face what's coming. A person diagnosed with any number of diseases, you know, for them to just say, I can't face that. The answer is, I don't know. And the reason I don't know goes back to what I said, that the language of Nachmanides I felt was cryptic. I don't know where the line is. Is it the fact that Saul has already been stabbed through and is therefore already in great pain? Or is it about what he's anticipating them doing to him next? That's not clear to me. At what point does this become something where we say, this is not acceptable, because even then the text didn't want to go to that point. It went to the point of saying acceptable, but at least understandable. I mean, in practice, I should state, it's a very important point to understand. In practice, for centuries, there hasn't been condemnation of people who committed suicide out of pain, out of depression, and so on. Even though you have on the books the idea of not giving a person full honors, in practice, for many centuries, the answer has been to assume that they were dealing with something which took them out of their right mind. They weren't actually competent at the time. I actually am familiar with one case in a community in which a person was buried outside of the cemetery because of this, and then the cemetery expanded, and now she's in. They go figure. Yes?
Do you have an obligation to talk with the person out of this?
That's a really good question. See, the question was, do you have the obligation to talk somebody out of it? We certainly have an obligation to encourage life, speaking broadly. Tomorrow night, I'm going to be speaking on a panel for UJA at a program. I was going to mention the program at the end. I'll mention it now instead. But I'll be speaking on a panel. It's at 7:30 at the North York Memorial Community Hall, or Community Memorial Hall. I always get confused. It's on Young. It's on end-of-life issues. And that's one of the questions that I'm looking at in terms of there, because there is a broader discussion. It's not about assisted death per se. It's about broader issues that come up. But one thing that I will lift out of what I'm going to say there is the point made by Rabbi Herschel Schachter in an article in 1986 on the issue of people who decide, I don't want to undergo treatment. Not talk about actively ending their life. They just say, I don't want chemo, I don't want, you know, fill in the blank, whatever it is. And he argued, based on sources that I'll be presenting then, that if you're talking about a situation in which someone is in great pain, pain that people normally would not want to deal with, and normal people would say, I give up at this point, it is inappropriate to try to convince them to go through with treatment. He felt it was the wrong thing to do. So there is a point at which we say, don't push somebody to extend things where we don't have any hope of providing a remedy for what they're undergoing. Yes, Jeff.
I was surprised that a couple of the sources in relation to Shemuel, they said that it was permitted for him to take his own life, as opposed to saying it was forbidden, but he can't be held accountable for it because of the circumstances, either mental illness or the circumstances. Which is a very big difference.
Right.
And some of the other sources, and you yourself have said, it's not permitted, but we may not hold people accountable under certain circumstances, or we may not withdraw honors from them at the time of burial in the cemetery.
Right. So what you're saying is true. The answer is yes. The sources are contradictory. You find these two 13th century sources which say, which use the word mutter, right? They say permitted. And then you find it walked back by other sources to say, well, not permitted, but understandable and not to be condemned. I could speculate. I would feel irresponsible speculating. But I wonder if you have a Nachmanides who's writing in 13th century Spain, and you have Rabbeinu Asher, who was driven out of Germany by persecution to go to Spain. I wonder if they're not a little bit more familiar with life facing the sorts of things that Shaul and Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion faced than people are in the Jewish world today, thank God. In other words, they're living in a world of early stage Inquisition. They're dealing with people who are being killed and tortured for being Jewish. It seems to me there may be a greater comprehension, frankly, for them than for someone today. And that may be part of it, but I'm very hesitant about that speculation. Yeah. We're obligated to take care of them. We're obligated to help them. The question comes up in Jewish law. We're told to violate Shabbat to save a life. What if it's of somebody who's trying to end his life? And the answer is we still try to save their life and still violate Shabbat in order to do it. So, yes, the answer is that our obligation is to help them in any way that we are able. Does that answer your question?
I mean, in terms of punishment. Like
there is no punishment. No. Yes? Sure.
Is there a difference between actually committing suicide or doing something to end your life versus refusing the treatment that you know will save your life?
Yes. And that goes back to the question that I was mentioning before, the question that I'm going to address in greater depth tomorrow night. There are circumstances in which Jewish law says, number one, you're entitled to decline, and number two, in certain cases, you are supposed to decline the treatment. There is no merit. If a person is suffering great pain, and all we're doing is extending a life of pain, that is not viewed necessarily as meritorious. That's not necessarily a good thing. So the answer is, yeah, there is a distinction between ending versus simply declining.
Well, what about something like leukemia, where you have to go to chemotherapy and you refuse it?
I know you're going to be there tomorrow night.
You're right.
Mitchell. I'm sorry, it's too far afield of our topic for me to go into it in real depth. Yeah.
Was that a case of violating Shabbat to save somebody?
Saving someone who has declared their intention to kill someone else?
So not just commit suicide, not committing suicide because you just made the point that we have to save their life in that circumstance. But someone who is actively seeking to kill other people, would there be an obligation to save?
If someone is actively seeking to kill other people, I'm responsible to stop him. And if I can't stop him alive, then to stop him dead.
In other words, you would not save their life on Shabbat?
If he's trying to kill someone else, we have the law of Radef, right? Someone who's pursuing somebody else to kill him is to be stopped. Ideally without killing him, but if necessary, then that's the way you do it. Yes, Andrea.
Going back to the Jewish Rabbi Hanina and Shaul, there seem to be like two opposite ends. On the one hand, Rabbi Hanina, I can't do anything to end my own life. I won't open my mouth and allow the flames to come in. But you did allow executioner to shorten his life.
Correct.
Whereas when you've got Shaul, who the spear bearer wouldn't end his life, but Shaul
right.
falls on his sword and kills himself.
Correct.
So was Rabbi Hanina wrong in not trying to end his own life sooner if he's allowing the executioner to do it?
Right, so in the piece of allowing the executioner to do it, the question was whether Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion is wrong for not simply opening his mouth and letting the flames end his life.
So, wrong, I mean, was he,
right. So keep in mind that the two questions are presented in a vacuum, meaning he answers the students before the executioner has made any offer. So the two questions are really addressed separately. He doesn't have a choice of either or, where you could say it would have been better for him to do this to himself than to have somebody else involved. It's really a question of, is he willing to hasten his own death? And he says, I'm not willing to, whether he's justified or not justified. And then separately, when offered the opportunity for someone else to do it, he's willing to allow them to do it, perhaps feeling that Lifnei Iver doesn't apply. I don't know whether he's right or wrong. I mean, he's Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan, so I'd feel awfully odd saying he's wrong. I feel just as bad about that one. Yeah. I don't know. The answer is I don't know. I haven't seen anyone in the literature on this suggest that what he did is improper. That I have not seen. Albert.
There's a logical inconsistency. Because he did open his mouth, did answer the students, therefore, so he followed their instructions.
Right. So I assume when they say open your mouth, it doesn't simply mean, the exhalation and inhalation involved in speaking. I had assumed that what they meant was something more dramatic that would actually hasten his death. I don't know how death by fire works, so to speak. I don't know. I could, throw that open to the doctors here if we want at the end to have a conversation about what they meant when they said open up your mouth and cause yourself to die earlier. Maybe it means inhaling the smoke. I don't know. It's an interesting question, but I'm not proficient in the medical side. I can offer you, the chance at the end if you want to discuss that. I don't know. So what we've seen so far, then, is a general statement against taking one's own life, a general statement against taking the life of another, with the understanding that Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan encouraged the executioner to do it, and with the understanding that Shaul ended his own life, and some sources say he's permitted to do so, and others say, well, he's not condemned for doing so. And it definitely has to give us pause when we're dealing with this topic. People asked me when the Supreme Court's ruling first came out, isn't this a cut and dry thing? There's nothing really to discuss within Judaism. I think we've now demonstrated that, like pretty much everything else under the sun, there is no such thing as cut and dry in Judaism. It doesn't work that way. So it needs discussion. But I want to move on to the next point, which is the argument that the Supreme Court made in terms of life, liberty, and security. Right? We stated in the beginning that the Supreme Court argues that by prohibiting assisted suicide, what we're doing is causing a person to take their own life sooner for fear that they won't be able to do it later on. What would Jewish law say in response to that logic? No. Why no?
I'm not even sure the sound logic there. You have no proof. There's no evidence. There's no empirical evidence that that is true.
Mm-hmm.
And you're never going to be able to design a situation to prove it. So it's character.
Right. So So the argument against is that it's conjecture. You don't actually know that somebody would ever do this because you can't know simultaneously what they would do in 15 years versus what is happening today. Either they're going to end their life today, so you won't know what would have happened then, or they won't end their life today, in which case you can't go back to now, so to speak, and make the decision. That's one argument. I'll give a more fundamental argument. In terms of this, this argument is what's called in the Talmud Chatei Bishvil Shetizkecha Verecha, or Shetizakecha Verecha. Sin in order to provide merit for somebody else. Meaning, the Talmud gives the following case. Somebody puts bread into the oven on Shabbat. They put dough into the oven to bake. Once the dough develops a crust, he will be liable for baking on Shabbat. So maybe I should take it out of the oven in order that he should not become liable for baking on Shabbat. If I take it out before it develops a crust, then he will be innocent. However, my action involved in taking out the bread is rabbinically prohibited. So should I violate a rabbinic prohibition in order to prevent him from being liable for a biblical prohibition? And the Talmud's answer is no. He did it. He knew what he was doing. And you don't have to become a sinner in order to mitigate his wrongdoing. And I think a similar point is relevant here. If we believe, and again, there are complications, but if we believe that it's wrong for him to take his life, we should not then say, well, I will take his life to prevent him from taking his life later on. Right? Even if, you follow what I'm saying? That's my gut response to that logic. I think the liberty and security arguments are more interesting. The Supreme Court's argument regarding liberty, saying that by preventing somebody from ending his life at the time of his choosing, you are stealing his liberty, or by forcing someone to endure this terrible pain, you are impinging on their security, I think those are more substantive arguments. Go ahead. Yeah.
The issue, well, that's more boiled down to suffering, subjective perception of suffering. I'm suffering because my hand goes to go against, I'd like to die. Is there not a place that someone already spoke to share with that person the remaining value of their current life? Rather than legalizing the ability to kill oneself and to get assistance, wouldn't it be better for the government to put into law means of helping people change their viewpoint?
So hold that thought. I want to come back to that in a little bit. I'm going to be, I will be looking at that. But I would argue, aside from the religious reasons not to commit suicide, which we've talked about, aside from that, there is a concept in Jewish law, as well as in secular law, of society's compelling interests. And society's compelling interests go ahead of those of the individual. My favorite example, I've used it in other classes some of you have been at, is regarding the issue of confidentiality, right? And specifically between a lawyer and a client. The rule is that a lawyer is not allowed to divulge information that a client says in a professional context. So in the event that the client says, you know, I'm engaged in fraud, and you, the lawyer, happen to know somebody who's going to be a victim of the fraud, the law is you're not allowed to tell them. Can't even go when they start talking about their investment. You can't hint to them. You can't do anything to in any way indicate that which you have learned from your client. In the event that there is physical bodily harm, serious physical harm, or serious psychological harm, then as a lawyer you are entitled to in Ontario. Not required to, but entitled to in Ontario. But otherwise, financial loss? No. Why not? Certainly, causing somebody to suffer financial harm is violating something in their charter, in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. True. However, society has a compelling interest in a system in which people trust their lawyers and in which they will be honest with their lawyers. If people think that the lawyer is going to go telling other people their secrets, then they won't tell the lawyer the truth, and you will have your whole system of legal representation will fall apart. Society has a compelling interest which at times overrides the rights of the individual. And my sense here is that that's a very big concern. Despite the great pain of people who are suffering with horrible diseases, and you can't ever forget that what we are talking about is horrible diseases. We're not talking hangnail. We're talking about really impossible situations. Nonetheless, if you take a look on your sheet at source number 15, this is for Belgium, but it exists elsewhere as well. February 2014, a year ago, the vote on Thursday by Belgium's House of Representatives removed all age restrictions on the right of the incurably sick to end their lives, a vote that has caused considerable controversy. I think it's the Netherlands. We have to be 17. Can't vote yet. We don't trust you to do that. but they can override parental refusal and have their lives ended. That's number one. And that's not, by the way, let me emphasize, that's not a slippery slope argument, because there's no slope. Meaning, once you tell me that I am taking somebody's rights by preventing them from suicide or preventing them from the assistance of somebody else, that's true whether that person is an adult or a minor. Doesn't make a difference. So that the it's not a slope. Once you say that a person has a right to assistance in suicide, they have that right whether they're 3 years old or whether they're 100 years old. Doesn't make a difference. Jack? Right. Right, but it actually said the former. Because what it said is that prohibiting someone from assisting, as the criminal code did, prohibiting somebody from assisting offends the right to life, liberty, and security of the patient. By prohibiting the assistance with suicide, I am indeed taking away their rights. That's the court's argument. And that's true whether this person is an adult or a minor. Doesn't matter. So that's the argument. But that's only one point. Second point within this was raised in an article in the National Post. I brought an excerpt for you in source number 16. I thank Jeff for bringing it to my attention. The question of, once you say that we need to protect a class of people and make sure that they have the ability, they have the access to assistance in ending their lives, where do you draw the line on that class? They talk about in this article the potential of people who have treatment-resistant depression. Right? Who are you to say this is pain and this is not pain? It's an irremediable condition, potentially. Now, in that article, they quoted experts who said depression is different because there's a lot of research being done and maybe they'll be able to come up with something. That's true for many diseases, number one. And number two, try telling that to the person who's dealing with this. It's really, it raises very serious questions in terms of where society is going to draw its line and how you're going to prevent people being in this new class inappropriately. Further, creating an approved type of suicide increases pressure on others to take that option. And studies have shown this, repeated studies have shown this, in terms of social acceptance of suicide. I brought you an excerpt from an abstract in source number 17. But there's a concern that once you create this, it becomes something that's part of the options. And there's pressure on people to take that option. And worst, if you take a look at source number 18, this is a piece from Margaret Dorey. I'm not sure if she pronounced it Dore or Dore. But she is a lawyer in Washington State and Oregon, where there is a form of legal physician-assisted suicide. And she writes about terrible pressure being brought on people to take the dose, as she describes, inappropriately. And you can see what she says there. I had two clients whose fathers signed up for the lethal dose. In the first case, one side of the family wanted the father to take the lethal dose while the other did not. He spent the last months of his life caught in the middle and traumatized over whether or not he should kill himself. My client, his adult daughter, was also traumatized. The father did not take the lethal dose and died a natural death. Second one takes the dose when he's high on alcohol. And there's more. I mean, I'm bringing you just a minor selection of some of the concerns that society ought to have about this. But if anyone has been in a situation of having a relative who was older or towards the end of a terminal illness, and they were in a hospital and needed certain equipment or needed certain treatments, and they were told at some point, you know, maybe it's time to let go, realize how much worse it would be if this were to go through in terms of that kind of pressure. I'm on both sides of the issue, in the sense that on the one hand, I want something for the people who are in pain, and on the other hand, I'm horrified about where this goes. So that's a major concern, and therefore my response to liberty and security, the right to life, liberty, and security, is to say, that's all well and good, but what about society's compelling interest? But let's go to the third point, the third area. And that is, so what alternatives does Judaism offer? If you're going to take the view that we're not allowed to end the life and that we're not allowed to assist, so what are you doing for the person who has these horrible illnesses, who are now stuck? And one point was made that we could try to help people with counseling. And that may have helped. That may help in certain circumstances. I brought you some sources here just because people aren't aware of it. That there's actually precedent in Jewish literature for praying for a person to die, praying for them to be released from their suffering. In source number 19, I brought you an example of it with Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the political as well as religious leader of the Jews in Israel in the beginning of the 3rd century. And his maid is, she prays that he should actually pass away. And her actions are approved of. If you flip onto the last side on source number 20, Rabbeinu Nissim, writing in 14th century Spain, says explicitly, "Pa'amim shetzarech levakesh rachamim al hachole sheyamus." Sometimes you have to pray for mercy for the patient to die. Kigon shemitzta'er hachole b'cholyo harbei v'yevsher lo sheyechya, such as where he's in great pain and he can't live. Now, mind you, authorities in Jewish law are very careful to say that one must continue to treat. They don't want you to say, well, I'm praying for the person to die, and therefore I certainly shouldn't be doing anything to treat them. If you look at Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, in source number 21, he writes, the person who is praying for the patient to die should still violate Shabbat to save his life. Because you're stuck, essentially. That's the bottom line. There is, Chaim Palagi, writing, I think, in the 19th century, contended that if you're responsible for someone's care, you're not entitled to pray for them to die, because it's too great a conflict of interest. But that's one thing that people, I think, should be aware of, this debate and discussion regarding praying for somebody to die. There is an option that exists, which actually I discussed with a doctor who's here tonight, which at least some rabbis are comfortable recommending, and that is something called continuous sedation. Now, I distinguish between continuous sedation and terminal sedation, and that goes back to the double effect question. The double effect, which we alluded to before, is where you apply a treatment that will have multiple results. One result being, in the case that's relevant here, remedying pain. The other result being bringing death closer or possibly actually causing death. It isn't just a medical discussion. It actually goes back to a Christian problem related to a biblical verse. The biblical verse talks about the case I mentioned before, killing somebody to prevent him from killing somebody else. And the Christian theologian involved was bothered because he said, well, wait a minute, you're killing a life in order to save another, but you're committing murder. How can that be? And the answer from a Jewish perspective is that we look at intent. Where your action, number one, is not guaranteed to kill the patient, and number two, is not intended to kill the patient, then it's acceptable for you to do this, even knowing that it involves a heightened risk. So you can give the patient a dose of morphine that, to the best of your knowledge, is not, you know, going to be immediately fatal, if your goal is to remedy pain. Where it's just being given as a part of a course of treatment and it's not needed, it's inappropriate. If you think this dose could actually do it, it's inappropriate. But otherwise, it is indeed allowed. And so going back to this point, terminal sedation would be sedating somebody to death. But continuous sedation means you keep them under. They're not conscious. And they could stay that way, and I don't know the medicine of it in terms of how long you can keep somebody like this, and I'm not actually calling on physicians right now to discuss it. I do know, though, that it can go on for a protracted period. And if you take a look at source number 22, you find a response from Rabbi Dr. Mordechai Halperin, who was dealing with the question of continuous sedation regarding somebody who had a 91-year-old mother who had all sorts of health problems, as you see listed here. And his answer was, if she wants this, she can have this. She's allowed to have this. And that would be a way to avoid ending her life, and it would still mitigate her pain. Once again, this is not medical advice. This isn't even halachic advice. Ask your rabbi for practical guidance. But I think it's important to be aware of. But most of all, what Jewish tradition and law demands is that society invest in finding ways to fight disease and to control pain. The physician is obligated to seek to control pain. In source number 23, I brought you a piece from Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who speaks of the double effect in context. But he raises the point that mitigating pain is part of the Torah's mandate to the physician. We have a mitzvah, we have an obligation of not standing by while other people are suffering. We have to find better ways to care for people. And this is, I think, another concern when you create an option of physician-assisted suicide, is that you're putting an option on the table that takes away the responsibility to find ways to treat and to find ways to mitigate pain. Because now we've offered an out. Imagine if some community somewhere would declare that there are people who are homeless. This is terrible. So what we're going to do is, we'll execute them. And now we don't have a homeless problem. Right? It's a horrific solution. Leave aside where this actually happens in one way or another, not necessarily as dramatically as I just stated it, but that's a separate point. The point is that if you create an out in society, then people don't try to solve the problem. If your out is, people have this disease, we end their lives at a certain stage, then you stop looking for ways, you stop investing in research to try to help. And that's a significant concern. Because there is an awful lot out there in terms of current pain mitigation and in what could be developed. If you take a look at source number 24 from one study, Pain Management and Care of the Terminal Patient, adequate interventions exist to control pain in 90 to 99% of patients. Now, the truth is 99% is not good enough. Because if there are 10,000 patients with a disease, right, and 99% of them are taken care of, what's 1% of 10,000? 100. That means 100 people who are suffering terribly. That's unacceptable. And that number is low. It depends on which disease you're talking about. So 99% isn't good enough. We need to be able to do better than that. But if you take a look at the last source from an article by Rabbi J. David Bleich, he points out, every prudent effort should be made to alleviate the patient's suffering. This includes aggressive treatment of pain, even to a degree which at present is not common in current medical practice. Physicians are reluctant to use morphine in high dosages because of the danger of depression of the cerebral center responsible for respiration. The effect of morphine administered in high doses is that the patient cannot control the muscles necessary for breathing. There is, however, no halachic objection to providing such medication in order to control pain in the case of terminal patients. This is the double effect discussion we just had. Even though palliation of pain may ultimately entail maintaining such a patient on a respirator. Similarly, there is no halachic objection to the use of heroin in the control of pain in terminal patients. The danger of addiction under such circumstances is, of course, hardly a significant consideration. And if you want to know his opinion on medical marijuana, you can see it here as well. He is in favor. He writes, Jewish teaching would enthusiastically endorse legalizing the use with adequate accompanying safeguards of those substances in treatment of terminal patients. So that there are options, and those options ought to be used and ought to be researched and ought to be developed. So that my answer to the first question, to wrap up what we're saying, and I'll stick around to discuss further. But the answer to our first question of what will Judaism say regarding ending a patient's life? Ending a patient's life, generally speaking, will not be allowed. Understanding that in the case of Rabbi Hanina ben Tradyon, he actually encourages the executioner, and we need to understand why that was okay, and we gave a couple of potential approaches to that. The enabling somebody to take his own life, is he allowed to take his own life? Once again, we said, generally speaking, suicide is not allowed. And yet, there does seem to be something going on with Shaul, with King Saul, in which very significant authorities were willing to use the word mutar, to say permitted, and at least to not condemn him because of the pain that he was in, understanding that there are other approaches to his story as well, which are taken by some of the commentators. The question of life, liberty, and security, the issue of life, the fact that the patient may take his life too early, so to speak, is not, from a Jewish law perspective, a valid consideration. The concern for liberty and security is valid, but the question would be, are you going to promote the needs of the individual over the needs of society when what you're proceeding with in this legislation will endanger society? And third, what alternatives would Judaism offer? So I noted the general sympathy for this in the idea that one may pray for a person to die, again, with some debate on the specifics. There is the option, which must be discussed medically, and I don't know enough to speak about it knowledgeably, but the option of continuous sedation. And there are other options for controlling pain, which should be invested in and which should be researched further, rather than necessarily say, we need to end the person's life, let's see what else can be done on their behalf. There is much more to say. As I said in the beginning, and I repeated somewhere in the middle, these are first thoughts on the topic. I do hope you signed in, because I want to be able to send out other information. At the least, I'm going to send out the digital version of the source sheets. So if you have not signed in, there are sheets over on the table over here. Thank you very much for coming, and I'll be glad to stay for a while and discuss further.